Here. The white wolf rose and rubbed against him. You'd best run back to your room, little sister. Septimor Dane will surely be lurking. The longer you hide, the sterner the penance. You'll be sewing all through the winter. When the spring thaw comes, they'll find your body with a needle still locked tight between your frozen fingers. Arya didn't think it was funny. I hate needlework, she said with passion. It's not fair. Nothing is fair, John said. He messed up her hair again and walked away from her, ghost moving silently beside him. Nymeria started to follow too, then stopped and came back when she saw that Arya was not coming. Reluctantly, she turned in the other direction. It was worse than John had thought. It wasn't Septimor Dane waiting in her room. It was Septimor Dane and her mother. Catelyn. Her son's crown was fresh from the forge, and it seemed to Catelyn Stark that the weight of it pressed heavy on Rob's head. The ancient crown of the Kings of Winter had been lost 3 centuries ago, yielded up to Aegon the Conqueror when Torrhen Stark knelt in submission. What Aegon had done with it, no man could say. Lord Hoster Smith had done his work well, and Rob's crown looked much as the other was said to have looked in the tales told of the Stark kings of old, an open circlet of hammered bronze, incised with the runes of the first men, surmounted by 9 black iron spikes wrought in the shape of longswords. Of gold and silver and gemstones it had none. Bronze and iron were the metals of winter, dark and strong to fight against the cold. As they waited in Riverrun's great hall for the prisoner to be brought before them, she saw Rob push back the crown so it rested upon the thick auburn mop of his hair. Moments later, he moved it forward again. Later, he gave it a quarter turn, as if that might make it sit more easily on his brow. It is no easy thing to wear a crown, Catelyn thought, watching, especially for a boy of 15 years. When the guards brought in the captive, Rob called for his sword. Oliver Frey offered it up, hilt first, and her son drew the blade and laid it bare across his knees, a threat plain for all to see. "Your Grace, here is the man you asked for," announced Robin Rhaegar, captain of the Tully Household Guard. "Kneel before the king, Lannister," Theon Greyjoy shouted. Sir Robin forced the prisoner to his knees. He did not look a lion, Catelyn reflected. This Sir Cleos Frey was the son of the Lady Jenna, who was sister to Lord Tywin Lannister. But he had none of the fabled Lannister beauty, the fair hair and green eyes. Instead, he had inherited the stringy brown locks, weak chin, and thin face of his sire, Sir Eamon Frey, old Lord Walder's second son. His eyes were pale and watery, and he could not seem to stop blinking. But perhaps that was only the light. The cells below River Run were dark and damp, and these days crowded as well. "Rise, Sir Cleos." Her son's voice was not as icy as his father's would have been, but he did not sound a boy of 15 either. War had made a man of him before his time. Morning light glimmered faintly against the edge of the steel across his knees. Yet it was not the sword that made Sir Cleos Frey anxious. It was the beast. Greywind, her son had named him, a dire wolf large as any elkhound, lean and smoke-dark, with eyes like molten gold. When the beast padded forward and sniffed at the captive knight, every man in the hall could smell the scent of fear. Sir Cleos had been taken during the battle in the Whispering Wood, where Grey Wind had ripped out the throats of 6 men. The knight scrambled up, edging away with such alacrity that some of the watchers laughed aloud.
Thank you, my lord.
Your Grace, barked Lord Umber, the Great John, ever the loudest of Rob's northern bannermen, and the truest and fiercest as well, or so he insisted. He had been the first to proclaim her son king in the north, and he would brook no slight to the honour of his new-made sovereign.
"Your grace,"
Sir Cleos corrected hastily, "pardons. He is not a bold man, this one," Catelyn thought. "More of a Frey than a Lannister, in truth. His cousin the Kingslayer would have been a much different matter. They would never have gotten that honorific through Sir Jaime Lannister's perfect teeth. I brought you from your cell to carry my message to your cousin, Cersei Lannister, in King's Landing. You'll travel under a peace banner, with 30 of my best men to escort you." Sir Cleos was visibly relieved.
"Then I should be most glad to bring his grace's message to the queen."
"Understand," Rob said. "I'm not giving you your freedom. Your grandfather, Lord Walden, pledged me his support, and that of House Frey. Many of your cousins and uncles rode with us in the Whispering Wood, but you chose to fight beneath the Lion's Banner. That makes you a Lannister, not a Frey. I want your pledge, on your honour as a knight, that after you deliver my message, you'll return with the Queen's reply and resume your captivity." Sir Cleos answered at once, "I do so vow." "Every man in this hall has heard you," warned Catelyn's brother, Sir Edmure Tully, who spoke for River Run and the Lords of the Trident in the place of their dying father. "If you do not return, the whole realm will know you forsworn." "I will do as I pledged," Sir Cleos replied stiffly. "What is this message?" "An offer of peace." Rob stood, longsword in hand. Grey Wind moved to his side. The hall grew hushed. "Tell the Queen Regent that if she meets my terms, I will sheathe this sword and make an end to the war between us." In the back of the hall, Catelyn glimpsed the tall, gaunt figure of Lord Rickard Carstark shoved through a rank of guards and out the door. No one else moved. Rob paid the disruption no mind. "Olivar, the paper," he commanded. The squire took his longsword and handed up a rolled parchment. Rob unrolled it. "First, the queen must release my sisters and provide them with transport by sea from King's Landing to White Harbour. It is to be understood that Sansa's betrothal to Joffrey Baratheon is at an end. When I receive word from my castellan that my sisters have returned unharmed to Winterfell, I will release the queen's cousins, the squire Willem Lannister and your brother Tion Frey, and give them safe escort to Castle Rock or wheresoever she desires them delivered." Catelyn Stark wished she could read the thoughts that hid behind each face, each furrowed brow and pair of tightened lips. "Secondly, my lord father's bones will be returned to us so he may rest beside his brother and sister in the crypts beneath Winterfell as he would have wished. The remains of the men of his household guard who died in his service at King's Landing must also be returned." Living men had gone south, and cold bones would return. Ned had the truth of it, she thought. His place was at Winterfell. He said as much. But would I hear him? No. "Go," I told him. "You must be Robert's hand, for the good of our house, for the sake of our children. My doing. Mine. No other." "Third, my father's great sword, Ice, will be delivered to my hand here at River Run." She watched her brother, Sir Edmure Tully, as he stood with his thumbs hooked over his sword belt, his face as still as stone. "Fourth, the queen will command her father, Lord Tywin, to release those knights and lords bannermen of mine that he took captive in the battle on the Green Fork of the Trident. Once he does so, I shall release my own captives taken in the Whispering Wood and the Battle of the Camps, save Jaime Lannister alone, who will remain my hostage for his father's good behaviour." She studied Theon Greyjoy's sly smile, wondering what it meant.
That young man had a way of looking as though he knew some secret jest that only he was privy to. Catelyn had never liked it. Lastly, King Joffrey and the Queen Regent must renounce all claims to dominion over the North. Henceforth we are no part of their realm, but a free and independent kingdom as of old. Our domain shall include all the Stark lands north of the Neck, and in addition the lands watered by the River Trident and its vassal streams, bounded by the Golden Tooth to the west and the Mountains of the Moon to the east.
"The King in the North!" boomed Great John Umber, a ham-sized fist hammering at the air as he shouted, "Stark! Stark! The King in the North!"
Rob rolled up the parchment again. "Maester Wyman has drawn a map showing the borders we claim. You shall have a copy for the Queen. Lord Tywin must withdraw beyond these borders and cease his raiding, burning, and pillaging. The Queen Regent and her son shall make no claims to taxes, incomes, nor service for my people, and shall free my lords and knights from all oaths of fealty, vows, pledges, debts, and obligations owed to the Iron Throne and the Houses Baratheon and Lannister. Additionally, the Lannisters shall deliver 10 highborn hostages to be mutually agreed upon as a pledge of peace. These I will treat as honored guests, according to their station. So long as the terms of this pact are abided with faithfully, I shall release 2 hostages every year and return them safely to their families." Rob tossed the rolled parchment at the knight's feet. "There are the terms. If she meets them, I'll give her peace. If not..." He whistled, and Grey Wind moved forward, snarling. "I'll give her another Whispering Wood."
"Stark!"
the Great John roared again, and now other voices took up the cry.
"Stark! Stark! King in the North!"
The dire wolf threw back his head and howled. Sir Cleos had gone the colour of curdled milk.
"The Queen shall hear your message, your Grace."
"Good," Rob said. "Sir Robin, see that he has a good meal and clean clothing. He's to ride at first light."
"As you command, your Grace,"
Sir Robin Rygar replied.
"Then we are done."
The assembled knights and lords bannermen bent their knees as Rob turned to leave, Grey Wind at his heels. Oliver Frey scrambled ahead to open the door. Catelyn followed them out, her brother at her side. "You did well," she told her son in the gallery that led from the rear of the hall, "though that business with the wolf was japery more befitting a boy than a king." Rob scratched Grey Wind behind the ear. "Did you see the look in his face, mother?" he asked, smiling. "What I saw was Lord Carstark walking out." "As did I." Rob lifted off his crown with both hands and gave it to Olivar. "Take this thing back to my bedchamber."
"At once, Your Grace."
The squire hurried off.
"I'll wager there were others who felt the same as Lord Carstark," her brother Edmure declared. "How can we talk of peace while the Lannisters spread like a pestilence over my father's domains, stealing his crops and slaughtering his people? I say again, we ought to be marching on Harrenhal."
"We lack the strength," Rob said, though unhappily. Edmure persisted.
"Do we grow stronger sitting here? Our host dwindles every day."
"And whose doing is that?" Catelyn snapped at her brother. It had been at Edmure's insistence that Rob had given the River Lords leave to depart after his crowning, each to defend his own lands. Sir Mark Piper and Lord Carl Vance had been the first to go. Lord Jonas Bracken had followed, vying to reclaim the burnt shell of his castle and bury his dead, and now Lord Jason Malister had announced his intent to return to his seat at Seaguard, still mercifully untouched by the fighting.
"You cannot ask my river lords to remain idle
while their fields are being pillaged and their people put to the sword," Sir Edmure said. "But Lord Carstark is a Northman. It would be an ill thing if he were to leave us."
"I'll speak with him," said Rob. "He lost two sons in the Whispering Wood. Who can blame him if he does not want to make peace with their killers, with my father's killers? More bloodshed will not bring your father back to us, or Lord Rickard's sons," Catelyn said. "An offer had to be made, though a wiser man might have offered sweeter terms. Any sweeter, and I would have gagged." Her son's beard had grown in redder than his auburn hair. Rob seemed to think it made him look fierce, royal, older. But bearded or no, he was still a youth of 15, and wanted vengeance no less than Rickard Carstark. It had been no easy thing to convince him to make even this offer, poor as it was. "Cersei Lannister will never consent to trade your sisters for a pair of cousins. It's her brother she'll want, as you know full well." She had told him as much before, but Catelyn was finding that kings do not listen half so attentively as sons. "I can't release the Kingslayer, not even if I wanted to. My lords would never abide it." "Your lords made you their king, and can unmake me just as easy. If your crown is the price we must pay to have Arya and Sansa return safely, we should pay it willingly. Half your lords would like to murder Lannister in his cell. If he should die while he's your prisoner, men will say that he well deserved it," Rob finished. "And your sisters?" Catelyn asked sharply. "Will they deserve their deaths as well?" "I promise you, if any harm comes to her brother, Cersei will pay us back blood for blood." "Lannister won't die," Rob said. "No one so much as speaks to him without my warrant. He has food, water, clean straw, more comfort than he has any right to. But I won't free him, not even for Arya and Sansa." Her son was looking down at her, Catelyn realized. Was it war that made him grow so fast, she wondered, or the crown they had put on his head? "Are you afraid to have Jaime Lannister in the field again? Is that the truth of it?" Grey Wind growled, as if he sensed Rob's anger, and Edmure Tully put a brotherly hand on Catelyn's shoulder. "Cat, don't. The boy has the right of this." "Don't call me the boy," Rob said, running on his uncle, his anger spitting out at once on poor Edmure, who had only meant to support him. "I'm almost a man grown, and a king. Your king, sir. And I don't fear Jaime Lannister. I defeated him once. I'll defeat him again if I must, only—" He pushed a fall of hair out of his eyes and gave a shake of the head. "I might have been able to trade the Kingslayer for father, but not for the girls." Her voice was icy quiet. "The girls are not important enough, are they?" Rob made no answer, but there was hurt in his eyes, blue eyes, Tully eyes, eyes she had given him. She had wounded him, but he was too much his father's son to admit it. "That was unworthy of me," she told herself. "Gods be good, what is to become of me? He's doing his best, trying so hard, I know it. I see it, and yet I have lost my Ned, the rock my life was built on. I could not bear to lose the girls as well." "I'll do all I can for my sisters," Rob said. "If the Queen has any sense, she'll accept my terms. If not, I'll make her rue the day she refused me." Plainly, he'd had enough of the subject. "Mother, are you certain you will not consent to go to the Twins? You would be farther from the fighting, and you could acquaint yourself with Lord Frey's daughters to help me choose my bride when the war is done." "He wants me gone," Catelyn thought wearily. "Kings are not supposed to have mothers, it would seem, and I tell him things he does not want to hear." "You're old enough to decide which of Lord Walder's girls you prefer without your mother's help, Rob." "Then go with Theon. He leaves on the morrow. He'll help the Malisters escort that lot of captives to Seagard, and then take ship for the Iron Islands. You could find a ship as well, and be back at Winterfell with the moon's turn, if the winds are kind. Bran and Rickon need you.
And you do not. Is that what you mean to say?
My lord father has little enough time remaining him. So long as your grandfather lives, my place is at River Run with him. I could command you to go. As king, I could.
Catelyn ignored that. I'll say again. I would sooner you sent someone else to Pike and kept Theon close to you.
Who better to treat with Balon Greyjoy than his son?
Jason Mallister, offered Catelyn.
Titus Blackwood. Stevron Frey. Anyone, but not Theon. Her son squatted beside Grey Wind, ruffling the wolf's fur and incidentally avoiding her eyes.
Theon's fought bravely for us. I told you how he saved Bran from those wildlings in the Wolf's Wood. If the Lannisters won't make peace, I'll have need of Lord Greyjoy's longships.
You'll have them sooner if you keep his son as hostage.
He's been a hostage half his life.
For good reason, Catelyn said. Balon Greyjoy is not a man to be trusted. He wore a crown himself, remember, if only for a season. He may aspire to wear one again.
Rob stood. I will not grudge him that. If I'm the king in the north, let him be king of the Iron Islands, if that's his desire. I'll give him a crown, gladly, so long as he helps us bring down the Lannisters.
Rob,
I'm sending Theon. Good day, mother. Grey Wind, come.
Rob walked off briskly, the direwolf padding beside him. Catelyn could only watch him go. Her son. And now her king. How queer that felt.
Command, she had told him, back in Moat Cailin. And so he did.
I'm going to visit father, she announced abruptly. Come with me, Edmure. I need to have a word with those new bowmen Sir Desmond is training. I'll visit him later.
If he still lives, Catelyn thought. But she said nothing. Her brother would sooner face battle than that sick room.
The shortest way to the central keep, where her father lay dying, was through the Guardswood, with its grass and wild flowers and thick stands of elm and redwood. A wealth of rustling leaves still clung to the branches of the trees, all ignorant of the word the White Raven had brought to River Run a fortnight past. Autumn had come, the conclave had declared, but the guards had not seen fit to tell the winds and woods as yet. For that Catelyn was duly grateful. Autumn was always a fearful time, with the spectre of winter looming ahead. Even the wisest man never knew whether his next harvest would be his last. Hoster Tully, Lord of River Run, lay abed in his solar, with his commanding view to the east, where the rivers Tumblestone and Red Fork met beyond the walls of his castle. He was sleeping when Catelyn entered, his hair and beard as white as his feather bed, his once portly frame turned small and frail by the death that grew within him. Beside the bed, still dressed in mail hauberk and travel-stained cloak, sat her father's brother, the Blackfish. His boots were dusty and spattered with dried mud.
Does Rob know your return, Uncle?
Sir Brynden Tully was Rob's eyes and ears, the commander of his scouts and outriders.
No, I came here straight from the stables when they told me the king was holding court. His grace will want to hear my tidings in private first, I think.
The Blackfish was a tall, lean man, grey of hair and precise in his movements, his clean-shaven face lined and windburnt.
How is he?
He asked. And she knew he did not mean Rob. Much the same. The maester gives him dream wine and milk of the puppy for his pain, so he sleeps most of the time and eats too little. He seems weaker with each day that passes.
Does he speak?
Yes, but there is less and less sense to the things he says. He talks of his regrets, of unfinished tasks, of people long dead, and times long past. Sometimes he does not know what season it is, or who I am. Once he called me by mother's name.
"He misses her still," Sir Brendan answered. "You have her face. I can see it in your cheekbones and your jaw."
"You remember more of her than I do. It has been a long time." She seated herself on the bed and brushed away a strand of fine white hair that had fallen across her father's face.
"Each time I ride out, I wonder if I shall find him alive or dead on my return."
Despite their quarrels, there was a deep bond between her father and the brother she had once disowned. "Well, at least you made your peace with him." They sat for a time in silence until Catelyn raised her head. "You spoke of tidings that Rob needed to hear." Lord Huster moaned and rolled onto his side, almost as if he had heard. Brendan stood.
"Come outside. Best if we do not wake him."
She followed him out onto the stone balcony that jutted three-sided from the solar like the prow of a ship. Her uncle glanced up, frowning.
"You can see it by day now. My men call it the Red Messenger. But what is the message?"
Catelyn raised her eyes to where the faint red line of the comet traced a path across the deep blue sky like a long scratch across the face of God. "The great John told Rob that the old gods have unfurled a red flag of vengeance for Ned. Edmure thinks it's an omen of victory for River Run. He sees a fish with a long tail in the Tully collars, red against blue." She sighed. "I wish I had their faith. Crimson is a Lannister collar."
"That thing's not crimson," Sir Brendan said, "nor Tully red. The mud red of the river.
That's blood up there, child, smeared across the sky."
"Our blood or theirs?"
"Was there ever a war where only one side bled?"
Her uncle gave a shake of the head.
"The riverlands are awash with blood, and flame all around the god's eye. The fighting has spread south to the Blackwater, and north across the Trident, almost to the Twins. Mark Piper and Carol Vance have won some small victories, and their southern lordling, Beric Dondarrion, has been raiding the raiders, falling upon Lord Tywin's foraging parties and vanishing back into the woods. It is said that Sir Burton Crakehall was boasting that he'd slain Dondarrion until he led his column into one of Lord Beric's traps and got every man of them killed.
Some of Ned's guards from King Landing are with this Lord Beric," Catelyn recalled. "May the guards preserve them."
"Dondarrion and this red priest who rides with him are clever enough to preserve themselves, if tales be true," her uncle said. "But your father's bannerman made a sadder tale. Rob should never have let them go. They've scattered like quail, each man trying to protect his own. And it's folly, Cat, folly. Jonas Bracken was wounded in the fighting amidst the ruins of his castle, and his nephew Hendry slain. Titus Blackwoods swept the Lannisters off his lands, but they took every cow and pig and speck of grain and left him nothing to defend but Raven Tree Hall and a scorched desert. Derry men recaptured their lord's keep, but held it less than a fortnight before Gregor Clegane descended on them and put the whole garrison to the sword, even their lord."
Catelyn was horror-struck. "Derry was only a child."
"Aye, and the last of his line as well. The boy would have brought a fine ransom. But what does gold mean to a frothing dog like Gregor Clegane? That beast's head would make a noble gift for all the people of the realm, I vow."
Catelyn knew Sir Gregor's evil reputation, yet still... "Don't speak to me of heads, uncle. Cersei has mounted Ned's on a spike above the walls of the Red Keep and left it for the crows and flies." Even now, it was hard for her to believe that he was truly gone. Some nights she would wake in darkness, half asleep, and for an instant expect to find him there beside her. Clegane is no more than Lord Tywin's catspaw. For Tywin Lannister, Lord of Castle Rock, Warden of the West, father to Queen Cersei, Sir Jaime the Kingslayer, and Tyrion the Imp, and grandfather to Joffrey Baratheon, the new crowned boy king, was the true danger, Catelyn believed.
True enough, Sir Brynden admitted, and Tywin Lannister is no man's fool. He sits safe behind the walls of Harrenhal, feeding his host on our harvest and burning what he does not take. Gregor is not the only dog he's loosed. Sir Aemery Lorch is in the field as well, and some sellsword out of Cahor who'd sooner maim a man than kill him. I've seen what they leave behind them. Whole villages put to the torch, women raped and mutilated, butchered children left unburied to draw wolves and wild dogs. It would sicken even the dead.
When Edmure hears this, he will rage.
And that will be just as Lord Tywin desires. Even terror has its purpose, Cat. Lannister wants to provoke us to battle.
Robber's likely to give him that wish, Catelyn said, fretful. He is restless as a cat sitting here, and Edmure and the great John and the others will urge him on. Her son had won two great victories, smashing Jaime Lannister in the Whispering Wood and routing his leadless hosts outside the walls of Riverrun in the Battle of the Camps. But from the way some of his bannermen spoke of him, he might have been Aegon the Conqueror reborn. Brynden Blackfish arched a bushy grey eyebrow.
More fool thee. My first rule of war, Cat, never give the enemy his wish. Lord Tywin would like to fight on a field of his own choosing. He wants us to march on Harrenhal. Harrenhal.
Every child of the Trident knew the tales told of Harrenhal, the vast fortress that King Harren the Black had raised beside the waters of God's Eye 300 years past, when the Seven Kingdoms had been Seven Kingdoms, and the Riverlands were ruled by the Iron Men from the Islands. In his pride, Harren had desired the highest hall and tallest towers in all Westeros. 40 years it had taken, rising like a great shadow on the shore of the lake, while Harren's armies plundered his neighbours for stone, lumber, gold, and workers. Thousands of captives died in his quarries, chained to his sledges, or labouring on his five colossal towers. Men froze by winter and sweltered in summer. Weirwoods that had stood 3,000 years were cut down for beams and rafters. Harren had beggared the Riverlands and the Iron Islands alike to ornament his dream. And when at last Harrenhal stood complete, on the very day King Harren took up residence, Aegon the Conqueror had come ashore at King's Landing. Catelyn could remember hearing old Nan tell the story to her own children back at Winterfell.
And King Harren learned that thick walls and high towers are small use against dragons,
the tale always ended,
for dragons fly.
Harren and all his line had perished in the fires that engulfed his monstrous fortress, and every house that held Harrenhal since had come to misfortune. Strong it might be, but it was a dark place, and cursed. I would not have Rob fight a battle in the shadow of that keep, Catelyn admitted.
Yet we must do something, Uncle.
And soon,
her uncle agreed. I have not told you the worst of it, child. The men I sent west have brought back word that a new host is gathering at Casterly Rock.
Another Lannister army? The thought made her ill. Rob must be told at once. Who will command?
Sir Stafford Lannister, it said.
He turned to gaze out over the rivers, his red and blue cloak stirring in the breeze. Another nephew? The Lannisters of Castle Rock were a damnably large and fertile house.
Cousin
Sir Brendan corrected. A brother to Lord Tywin's late wife, so twice related. An old man and a bit of a dullard, but he has a son, Sir Devon, who is more formidable.
Then let us hope it is the father and not the son who takes his army into the field.
We have some time yet before we must face them. This lot will be sellswords, free riders, and green boys from the stews of Lannisport. Sir Stafford must see that they are armed and drilled before he dare risk battle, and make no mistake, Lord Tywin is not the Kingslayer. He will not rush in heedless. He will wait patiently for Sir Stafford to march before he stirs from behind the walls of Harrenhal.
Unless, said Catelyn.
Yes,
Sir Brendan prompted. Unless he must leave Harrenhal, she said, to face some other threat. Her uncle looked at her thoughtfully.
Lord Renly?
King Renly. If she would ask help from the man, she would need to grant him the style he had claimed for himself.
Perhaps,
the Blackfish smiled, a dangerous smile.
He'll want something, though.
He'll want what kings always want, she said. Homage.
Circe. A cold rain was falling, turning the walls and ramparts of the Red Keep dark as blood. The queen held the king's hand and led him firmly across the muddy yard to where her litter waited with its escort.
"Uncle Jamie said I could ride my horse and throw pennies to the small folk," the boy objected.
"Do you want to catch a chill?" She would not risk it. Tommen had never been as robust as Joffrey. "Your grandfather would want you to look a proper king at his wake. We will not appear at the great sept wet and bedraggled. Bad enough I must wear mourning again." Black had never been a happy colour on her. With her fair skin it made her look half a corpse herself. Circe had risen an hour before dawn to bathe and fix her hair, and she did not intend to let the rain destroy her efforts. Inside the litter, Tommen settled back against his pillows and peered out at the falling rain. "The gods are weeping for Grandfather. Lady Jocelyn says the raindrops are their tears. Jocelyn Swift is a fool. If the gods could weep, they would have wept for your brother. Rain is rain. Close the curtain before you let any more in. That mantle is sable. Would you have it soaked?" Tommen did as he was bid. His meekness troubled her. A king had to be strong. Joffrey would have argued. He was never easy to cow. "Don't slump so," she told Tommen. "Sit like a king. Put your shoulders back and straighten your crown. Do you want it to tumble off your head in front of all your lords?" "No, mother." The boy sat straight and reached up to fix the crown. Joff's crown was too big for him. Tommen had always inclined to plumpness, but his face seemed thinner now. "Is he eating well?" She must remember to ask the steward. She could not risk Tommen growing ill, not with Myrcella in the hands of the Dornishmen. "He will grow into Joff's crown in time. Until he did, a smaller one might be needed, one that did not threaten to swallow his head." She would take it up with the goldsmiths. The litter made its slow way down Aegon's high hill. Two Kingsguard rode before them, white knights on white horses with white cloaks hanging sodden from their shoulders. Behind came 50 Lannister guardsmen in gold and crimson. Tommen peered through the drapes at the empty streets. "I thought there would be more people. When Father died, all the people came out to watch us go by." "This rain has driven them inside." King's Landing had never loved Lord Tywin. He never wanted love, though. "You cannot eat love, nor buy a horse with it, nor warm your halls on a cold night," she heard him tell Jamie once, when her brother had been no older than Tommen. At the great sept of Baelor, that magnificence in marble atop Visenya's hill, The little knot of mourners were outnumbered by the gold cloaks that Sir Adam Marbrand had drawn up across the plaza. "More will turn out later," the Queen told herself as Sir Merin Trant helped her from the litter. Only the highborn and their retinues were to be admitted to the morning service. There would be another in the afternoon for the commons, and the evening prayers were open to all. Circe would need to return for that, so that the small folk might see her mourn. The mob must have its show. It was a nuisance. She had offices to fill, a war to win, a realm to rule. Her father would have understood that. The High Septon met them at the top of the steps, a bent old man with a wispy grey beard. He was so stooped by the weight of his ornate embroidered robes that his eyes were on a level with the Queen's breasts, though his crown, an airy confection of cut crystal and spun gold, added a good foot and a half to his height. Lord Tywin had given him that crown to replace the one that was lost when the mob killed the previous High Septon. They had pulled the fat fool from his litter and torn him apart the day Myrcella sailed for Dawn. That one was a great glutton and biddable. This one. This High Septon was of Tyrion's making, Circe recalled suddenly. It was a disquieting thought. The old man's spotted hand looked like a chicken claw as it poked from a sleeve encrusted with golden scrollwork and small crystals. Circe knelt on the wet marble and kissed his fingers and bid Tommen to do the same. What does he know of me? How much did the dwarf tell him? The High Septon smiled as he escorted her into the sept, but was it a threatening smile full of unspoken knowledge, or just some vacuous twitch of an old man's wrinkled lips? The Queen could not be certain. They made their way through the Hall of Lamps beneath coloured globes of leaded glass, Tommen's hand in hers. Trant and Kettle Black flanked them, water dripping from their wet cloaks to puddle on the floor. The High Septon walked slowly, leaning on a weirwood staff topped by a crystal orb. Seven of the most devout attended him, shimmering in cloth of silver. Tommen wore cloth of gold beneath his sable mantle, the Queen an old gown of black velvet lined with ermine. There'd been no time to have a new one made, and she could not wear the same dress she had worn for Joffrey, nor the one she'd buried Robert in. At least I will not be expected to don mourning for Tyrion. I shall dress in crimson silk and cloth of gold for that, and wear rubies in my hair. The man who brought her the dwarf's head would be raised to lordship, she had proclaimed, no matter how mean and low his birth or station. Ravens were carrying her promise to every part of the Seven Kingdoms, and soon enough word would cross the narrow sea to the nine free cities and the lands beyond. Let the imp run to the ends of the earth. He will not escape me. The royal procession passed through the inner doors into the cavernous heart of the great sept and down a wide aisle, one of seven that met beneath the dome. To right and left, high-born mourners sank to their knees as the king and queen went by. Many of her father's bannermen were here, and knights who had fought beside Lord Tywin in half a hundred battles. The sight of them made her feel more confident. I am not without friends. Under the great sept's lofty dome of glass and gold and crystal, Lord Tywin Lannister's body rested upon a stepped marble bier. At its head, Jaime stood at vigil, his one good hand curled about the hilt of a tall golden greatsword whose point rested on the floor. The hooded cloak he wore was as white as freshly fallen snow, and the scales of his long hauberk were mother-of-pearl, chased with gold. Lord Tywin would have wanted him in Lannister gold and crimson, she thought. It always angered him to see Jaime all in white. Her brother was growing his beard again as well. The stubble covered his jaw and cheeks and gave his face a rough, uncouth look. He might at least have waited till father's bones were interred beneath the rock. Circe led the king up three short steps to kneel beside the body. Tommen's eyes were filled with tears. "Weep quietly," she told him, leaning close. "You are a king, not a squalling child. Your lords are watching you." The boy swiped the tears away with the back of his hand. He had her eyes, emerald green, as large and bright as Jamie's eyes had been when he was Tommen's age. Her brother had been such a pretty boy, but fierce as well, as fierce as Joffrey, a true lion cub. The queen put her arm around Tommen and kissed his golden curls. "He will need me to teach him how to rule and keep him safe from his enemies." Some of them stood around them even now, pretending to be friends. The Silent Sisters had armored Lord Tywin as if to fight some final battle. He wore his finest plate, heavy steel enameled, a deep, dark crimson with gold inlay on his gauntlets, greaves, and breastplate. His rondels were golden sunbursts, a golden lioness crouched upon each shoulder. A maned lion crested the great helm beside his head. Upon his chest lay a long sword in a gilded scabbard studded with rubies, his hands folded about its hilt in gloves of gilded mail. "Even in death, his face is noble," she thought, "although the mouth..." The corners of her father's lips curved upward ever so slightly, giving him a look of vague bemusement. That should not be. She blamed Pycelle. He should have told the Silent Sisters that Lord Tywin Lannister never smiled. The man is as useless as nipples on a breastplate. That half-smile made Lord Tywin seem less fearful somehow, that and the fact that his eyes were closed. Her father's eyes had always been unsettling, pale green, almost luminous, flecked with gold. His eyes could see inside you, could see how weak and worthless and ugly you were down deep. When he looked at you, you knew. Unbidden, a memory came to her of the feast King Aerys had thrown when Circe first came to court, a girl as green as summer grass. Old Merryweather had been nattering about raising the duty on wine when Lord Ryker said, "If we need gold, his grace should sit Lord Tywin on his chamber pot." Aerys and his lickspittles laughed loudly whilst father stared at Ryker over his wine cup. Long after the merriment had died, that gaze had lingered. Ryker turned away, turned back, met father's eyes, then ignored them, drank a tankard of ale and stalked off red-faced, defeated by a pair of unflinching eyes. "Lord Tywin's eyes are closed forever now," Circe thought. "It is my look they will flinch from now, my frown that they must fear. I am a lion too." It was gloomy within the sept, with the sky so grey outside. If the rain ever stopped, the sun would slant down through the hanging crystals to drape the corpse in rainbows. The Lord of Casterly Rock deserved rainbows. He had been a great man. "I shall be greater, though. 1,000 years from now, when the maesters write about this time, you shall be remembered only as Queen Cersei's sire." "Mother," Tommen tugged her sleeve, "what smells so bad?" "My lord, father." "Death." She could smell it too, a faint whisper of decay that made her want to wrinkle her nose. Circe paid it no mind. The 7 septons in the silver robes stood behind the bier, beseeching the father above to judge Lord Tywin justly. When they were done, 77 scepters gathered before the altar of the mother and began to sing to her for mercy. Tommen was fidgeting by then, and even the queen's knees had begun to ache. She glanced at Jamie. Her twin stood as if he had been carved from stone and would not meet her eyes. On the benches, their uncle Kevin knelt, with his shoulders slumped, his son beside him. "Lancel looks worse than father. Though only 17, he might have passed for 70. Grey-faced, gaunt, with hollow cheeks, sunken eyes and hair as white and brittle as chalk. How can Lancel be among the living when Tywin Lannister is dead? Have the gods taken leave of their wits?" Lord Giles was coughing more than usual and covering his nose with a square of red silk. He can smell it too. Grand Maester Pycelle had his eyes closed. "If he has fallen asleep, I swear I will have him whipped." To the right of the bier knelt the Tyrells, the Lord of Highgarden, his hideous mother and vapid wife, his son Garlan, and his daughter Margaery. Queen Marjorie, she reminded herself. Joff's widow and Tommen's wife-to-be. Marjorie looked very like her brother, the Knight of Flowers. The Queen wondered if they had other things in common. Our little Rose has a good many ladies waiting attendance on her, night and day. They were with her now, almost a dozen of them. Circe studied their faces, wondering. Who is the most fearful, the most wanton, the hungriest for favor? Who has the loosest tongue? She would need to make a point of finding out. It was a relief when the singing finally ended. The smell coming off her father's corpse seemed to have grown stronger. Most of the mourners had the decency to pretend that nothing was amiss, but Circe saw two of Lady Marjorie's cousins wrinkling their little Tyrell noses. As she and Tommen were walking back down the aisle, the Queen thought she heard someone mutter privy and chortle, but when she turned her head to see who had spoken, a sea of solemn faces gazed at her blankly. They would never have dared make japes about him when he was still alive. He would have turned their bowels to water with a look. Back out in the Hall of Lamps, the mourners buzzed about them, thick as flies, eager to shower her with useless condolences. The red wine twins both kissed her hand, their father her cheeks. Halline the pyromancer promised her that a flaming hand would burn in the sky above the city on the day her father's bones went west. Between coughs, Lord Giles told her that he had hired a master stone carver to make a statue of Lord Tywin to stand eternal vigil beside the Lion Gate. Sir Lambert Turnberry appeared with a patch over his right eye, swearing that he would wear it until he could bring her the head of her dwarf brother. No sooner had the Queen escaped the clutches of that fool when she found herself cornered by Lady Felice of Stokeworth and her husband, Sir Balmain Birch. "My lady mother sends her regrets, Your Grace," Felice burbled at her. "Lollies has been taken to bed with the child, and she felt the need to stay with her. She begs that you forgive her, and said I should ask you. My mother admired your late father above all other men. Should my sister have a little boy, it is her wish that we might name him Tywin, if it please you." Circe stared at her aghast. "Your lackwit sister gets herself raped by half of King's Landing, and Tanda thinks to honour the bastard with my lord father's name? I think not." Felice flinched back as if she'd been slapped, but her husband only stroked his thick blonde moustache with a thumb. "I told Lady Tanda as much. We shall find a more fitting name for Lollies's bastard. You have my word." "See that you do." Circe showed them a shoulder and moved away. Tommen had fallen into the clutches of Marjorie Tyrell and her grandmother, she saw. The Queen of Thorns was so short that for an instant Circe took her for another child. Before she could rescue her son from the roses, the press brought her face to face with her uncle. When the Queen reminded him of their meeting later, Sir Kevin gave a weary nod and begged leave to withdraw. But Lancel lingered, the very picture of a man with one foot in the grave. But is he climbing in or climbing out? Circe forced herself to smile. "Lancel, I am happy to see you looking so much stronger. Maester Balabar brought us such dire reports. We feared for your life. But I would have thought you on your way to Dari by now to take up your lordship." Her father had made Lancel a lord after the Battle of the Blackwater as a sop to his brother Kevin. "Not as yet. There are outlaws in my castle." Her cousin's voice was as wispy as the moustache on his upper lip. Though his hair had gone white, his moustache fuzz remained a sandy colour. Circe had often gazed up at it while the boy was inside her, pumping dutifully away. "It looks like a smudge of dirt on his lip." She used to threaten to scrub it off with a little spit. "The Riverlands have need of a strong hand, my father says." "A pity that they're getting yours," she wanted to say. Instead, she smiled. "And you are to be wed as well." A gloomy look passed across the young knight's ravaged face.
A Frey girl, and not of my choosing. She is not even a maiden, a widow of Dari blood. My father says that will help me with the peasants, but the peasants are all dead. He reached for her hand. It is cruel, Circe. Your grace knows that I love House Lannister. She finished for him. No one can doubt that, Lancel. May your wife give you strong sons. Best not let her lord grandfather host the wedding, though. I know you will do many noble deeds in Dari. Lancel nodded, plainly miserable. When it seemed that I might die, my father brought the High Septon to pray for me. He is a good man. Her cousin's eyes were wet and shiny, a child's eyes in an old man's face. He says the mother spared me for some holy purpose so I might atone for my sins. Circe wondered how he intended to atone for her. Knighting him was a mistake and bedding him a bigger one. Lancel was a weak reed, and she liked his new-found piety not at all. He had been much more amusing when he was trying to be Jaime. What has this mewling fool told the High Septon, and what will he tell his little Frey when they lie together in the dark? If he confessed to bedding Circe, well, she could weather that. Men were always lying about women. She would put it down as the braggadocio of a callow boy smitten by her beauty. If he sings of Robert and the strong wine, though, atonement is best achieved through prayer, Circe told him. A silent prayer. She left him to think about that and girded herself to face the Tyrell host. Margaery embraced her like a sister, which the queen found presumptuous, but this was not the place to reproach her. Lady Allery and the cousins contented themselves with kissing fingers. Lady Graceford, who was large with child, asked the queen's leave to name it Tywin if it were a boy, or Lana if it were a girl. "Another one," she almost groaned. "The realm will drown in Tywin's." She gave consent as graciously as she could, feigning delight. It was Lady Merryweather who truly pleased her. "Your Grace," that one said in her sultry, mearish tones, "I have sent word to my friends across the narrow sea, asking them to seize the imp at once, should he show his ugly face in the free cities. Do you have many friends across the water?" "In Mere, many, in Lys as well, and Tyrosh. Men of power." Circe could well believe it. The Meerish woman was too beautiful by half, long-legged and full-breasted, with smooth olive skin, ripe lips, huge dark eyes, and thick black hair that always looked as if she'd just come from bed. She even smells of sin, like some exotic lotus. "Lord Merryweather and I wish only to serve your grace and the little king," the woman purred, with a look that was as pregnant as Lady Graceford. "This one is ambitious, and her lord is proud but poor. We must speak again, my lady. Tena, is it? You are most kind. I know that we shall be great friends." Then the Lord of Highgarden descended on her. Mace Tyrell was no more than 10 years older than Circe, yet she thought of him as her father's age, not her own. He was not quite so tall as Lord Tywin had been, but elsewise he was bigger, with a thick chest and a gut grown even thicker. His hair was chestnut-coloured, but there were specks of white and grey in his beard. His face was often red. "Lord Tywin was a great man, an extraordinary man," he declared ponderously, after he had kissed both her cheeks. "We shall never see his like again, I fear." "You are looking at his like, fool," Circe thought. "It is his daughter standing here before you." But she needed Tyrell and the strength of Highgarden to keep Tommen on his throne, so all she said was, "He will be greatly missed." Tyrell put a hand upon her shoulder. "No man alive is fit to don Lord Tywin's armor, that is plain. Still, the realm goes on and must be ruled. If there is aught that I might do to serve in this dark hour, your grace need only ask." "If you want to be the king's hand, my lord, have the courage to say it plainly." The queen smiled.
Let him read into that as much as he likes. Surely my lord is needed in the reach. My son Willis is an able lad, the man replied, refusing to take her perfectly good hint. His leg may be twisted, but he has no want of wits, and Garland will soon take Brightwater.